afternoon. Welcome to another episode of Medical Narratives, the podcast where we explore best practices, groundbreaking medical research, and advancements in medicine. I'm Dr. Michael Gordon, the host of the Medical Narrative podcast. In today's episode, we review the news that lecanemab has received approval as a treatment for early Alzheimer's disease from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, a potential much-needed good news in Alzheimer's treatment. Our guest today is Dr. Sharon Cohn. Dr. Cohn is a behavioral neurologist and the medical director of the Toronto Memory Program, a community-based medical facility which she established in 1996 for the purpose of enhancing diagnosis and treatment for individuals with Alzheimer's disease and related disorders. Her memory clinic and dementia research are among the most active in Canada. Dr. Cohn has over 30 years of experience in clinical research and has been a site principal investigator for over 180 pharmacological trials in dementia, including phase one trials. She represents Canada on international advisory boards and steering committees and is a consultant to a wide range of stakeholders, including government organizations and patient advocacy groups. She is a frequent lecturer and contributes to media events, including those on medical ethics. She is known for her advocacy of individuals with neurodegenerative diseases. Despite academic and hospital appointments, Dr. Cohn has always chosen to practice in the community, in keeping with her belief that dementia care and clinical research are best offered in the real-world setting. So as many of you are aware, Alzheimer's disease is a devastating neurodegenerative condition that affects millions of people worldwide, including a significant number of Canadians. According to recent data, over 500,000 Canadians currently suffer from Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, and that number is expected to rise significantly in the coming years. The need for more effective treatments is more critical than ever. Sharon, we've decided that for the purpose of this interview, we're going to call each other by first names as we know each other for about 30 years prior to my rejoining the world of medicine and working in the Toronto Memory Clinic. Since the introduction of the first cholinesterase inhibitors in the late 1990s, it has been such a challenge to bring new and more effective drugs to the market. I'm going to first relate my first experience of the world of dementia, starting with what I learned about it in medical school in Scotland. I graduated from University of St. Andrews, the Dundee campus in 1966. When we talked about people who nowadays we diagnose as having dementia, my professor would say, she's a wee bit dotty. That was it. That was the diagnostic label, dotty. In Canada, I at some point worked for the provincial government's Drug Quality and Therapeutics Committee, the so-called DQTC, when Aricept was brought to the committee's deliberation. We were all very skeptical, but in view of the fact that there were really no other treatments available, it was approved with some limiting provisos. Now, with many years of experience, most of us in geriatric and behavioral neurology practice understands its benefits and its many limitations. Through the years, we have seen many potentially promising new therapies, only to see the hopes crash at late trials and the drugs. Sharon, can you tell us, please, about the recent approval of lecanemab, you can pronounce it properly for me, by the FDA in the USA, and what it means for patients and healthcare professionals?
Thank you, Michael. Yes, I'm delighted to. So with the FDA's full traditional approval, July 6th, of lecanemab, we now have the first drug ever approved as a disease-modifying agent. In other words, to slow the progression of the underlying pathobiology of the disease. So it acts way upstream from the cholinesterase inhibitors that are, you know, the cholinesterase inhibitors are trying to extend the life of acetylcholine that's being produced in less supply because so many neurons have died. Here we're looking at clearing a very early pathologic process of Alzheimer's, amyloid plaque, or amyloid in its various species. And so in doing this, what the lecanemab data have shown and what the FDA has appreciated is we are not just slowing down disease pathobiology, but patients have a slower trajectory. And that's why this is so important. And we can talk more about the details of that trial. We did have in 2021, a drug approved on conditional approval by the FDA, aducanumab or Aduhelm. That's still a conditional approval with a confirmatory trial ongoing. But now we have a drug with full approval, which opens up all kinds of possibilities.
Erin, can you elaborate on the clinical trial process for this drug?
Sure. Lecanemab is an anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody, and it has high specificity for large aggregated soluble amyloid aggregates. It also targets plaque, and it's delivered by intravenous infusion every 2 weeks. In the phase two study, in patients with mild cognitive impairment and mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, all of these patients had either PET amyloid confirmation or CSF amyloid confirmation that their mild cognitive impairment or their dementia was due to Alzheimer's. There was evidence of disease slowing as well as robust lowering of amyloid and downstream markers of tau and other sort of bad actors in the Alzheimer's pathologics cascade. So that phase two study led the FDA to grant accelerated pathway conditional approval based on amyloid lowering in January of this year, January 6, 2023. By July of this year, July 6, the FDA had the phase three data. Phase three, Clarity AD, was designed as a confirmatory study, also in MCI and mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, a larger population, 1,795 patients randomized to either active drug, lecanemab, or placebo, and followed for 18 months. And this confirmatory study showed, again, very robust lowering of amyloid, but also clinical benefit. And the clinical benefit was striking. There was slowing of disease on the primary outcome measure, which, Michael, you'll be familiar with, called the CDR, sum of boxes, but basically a composite scale of cognition and function. But on all secondary outcomes, there was also highly statistically significant disease slowing. So on functional scales, particularly in this mild population, IADLs were preserved longer. On the ADAS-Cog, which is sort of a detailed cognitive test battery, there was disease slowing. And even on exploratory endpoints, which consisted of quality of life scales, which you often don't see in Alzheimer's drug development, the quality of life scales, both the general quality of life, more disease-specific quality of life scales, and care partner burden scales, they all showed less progression of burden. And we know with Alzheimer's disease, as the disease progresses, quality of life goes down for patients, the burden goes up for care partners and families. So the consistency of the data set is remarkable for lecanemab. And this has led to the approval, but there is a study going on that is a secondary prevention study. We have it at Toronto Memory Program and a few other sites across Canada. It's an international study looking at whether lecanemab can prevent people who are cognitively normal but have amyloid in the brain from going on to mild cognitive impairments. We're going even earlier now. That study won't read out for a few years, but we're very hopeful. And other things going on with lecanemab development, it's an intravenous infusion every 2 weeks, as I said. So a subcutaneous dose that could be administered at home by the patient, him or herself, or a family member would really, increase convenience and access. And that is an ongoing study and hopefully will become a future modality for administration.
So the next question, Sharon, which I think people, even though right now in Canada, and we'll get to that, it's not going to be available for physicians, but what are the challenges? Let's say, for argument's sake, we were in the United States and it's been approved. what would be the framework with which a physician who's caring for people with cognitive impairment, early MCI, what would be their sort of strategy for deciding and when to give somebody this drug?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question to look at the rollout, because the way we need to select patients for lecanemab and monitor patients has very little to do with how we've been doing this so far in treating Alzheimer's. We're looking for early patients now. For mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's, we haven't had anything approved, and many of these patients are a little neglected. They're told they have normal aging, or they're a bit anxious, or whatever they're told. These are exactly the patients we don't want to miss. So we need to, you know, maneuver our healthcare system so that we can diagnose early and people don't lose an opportunity. We need to establish access to biomarkers, because having MCI or mild dementia, even if we think by clinical criteria, they are likely due to underlying Alzheimer's, we can be wrong so often. So we need to have access right now to PET scans for amyloid imaging or CSF analysis. So we need to scale those up, and they need to be affordable. In the future, it may be that blood-based biomarkers can serve that role, but not yet. So there are definitely hurdles. And then finding, enough specialists in the U.S. They are blessed with a higher number of neurologists than we have in Canada. But even so, there are wait lists to see a specialist, and there will be a demand for a treatment like lecanemab. So we need to establish centers of excellence. We need people in primary care to know, who they could tap or refer to, so that patients can have timely access, early diagnosis. There's going to be some disparity, because not everybody lives in a center or in a geography where there are experts and there are PET centers and there's infusion centers. So it's going to be challenging, and people need MRI monitoring from a safety perspective as well. So people will have to have MRIs. We don't monitor disease progression with MRIs in the clinic when we prescribe donepezil or galantamine. It's not necessary, but with these monoclonal antibodies for amyloid, we need to. So that needs to also be built into. So you need a patient navigator or something like that to keep on track of how people are doing and keeping them safe and monitoring them. It will be a shakeup, but I'm very hopeful that things are going the right way. There have been discussions with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and things are looking favorable now. It looks like, the cost of the drug is going to be substantially covered, that things like ApoE genotyping, access to MRI, other things that a physician will need to have in place so that they can safely decide when their patient who's appropriate for this treatment. These are starting to be funded. So it's an exciting time, definitely.
So Sharon, where are we with Health Canada? I know that in my experience at the DQTC, there were many medications in which the approval occurred earlier in the FDA, and that was usually an impetus for the HPB, the equivalent of the FDA in Canada, to look into the drug seriously. On the other hand, I know that Canada sometimes did not follow the FDA, and of course, sometimes that was a good move. And we know of these drugs that unfortunately ended up having lots of serious side effects, and Health Canada did not approve them. But what do you think is going to happen with Health Canada now?
Yeah, it's a great question, Michael. And of course, we're here in Canada, and our patients are asking us, can I write a prescription? Can they go to Buffalo? How can they access Leqembi?
Yeah.
So fortunately, ACI has submitted their dossier of the phase 3 data to Health Canada. That happened in the spring of this year. Health Canada has agreed to review it, so they've acknowledged this submission. The timeline is such that we probably won't have an answer from Health Canada until the first quarter, maybe not till March of 2024. So, if you have MCI or mild AD, that sounds like too long to wait. But really, that'll just be around the corner. This time next year, hopefully we're rolling out treatment, we're prescribing this drug. I am hopeful. One can never be sure what any individual regulator will decide. but I think the data is very strong. The need is very great. We don't have an alternative. We don't have any other disease modifiers. Yes, there are some safety risks, but they can be monitored and managed. So I'm hopeful that Health Canada will do their careful review and that we will have lecanemab as an option for patients this time next year.
I think the importance is for all of us to remember, irrespective of which province we live in, it may be approved by Health Canada, then each province has to decide if they will fund it. And as I saw when I experienced Aricept, when it's a drug that really is a game changer, and even though it wasn't as big a game changer as this might be, considering that there was nothing, I mean, all we did was treat the symptoms, you know, BPSD at the time, I suspect that, and of course, it's always, as Ontario goes, so goes the country in terms of funding. Everybody looks to Ontario, because we have, in fact, a very rigorous process, having sat on the committee, I know. So I'm hopeful, and I'm looking forward to having another available possibility for treatment of a devastating disease. It's like the first time I saw furosemide being treated as a medical student, it changed the basis of treatment of acute pulmonary edema from almost a fatal disease to just take a couple of pills a day. I was just thinking, from my time on the DQCC, you know, one of the measures we always had was cost effectiveness, and one could argue about, and you might say, well, you know, this is an expensive drug, and it took somebody who understood health economics to say, this is a cheap drug. I mean, I'm talking about something like giving anticoagulants after hip surgery. Oh, that's expensive. No, breaking your hip is expensive. Getting a pulmonary embolus, that's expensive. Death is expensive. Well, it's not expensive, of course. Yeah. But I'm saying is that, do you think in the beginning, because of the cost, we've done this with other drugs, whether it works well or not, it would be limited to people like neurologists, geriatricians, people who have a higher level of experience and insight into the use of the drug before it becomes generally available. And I'm thinking of this because when Aricept first came out, I would find, and I still see it a lot, many family physicians would always refer to a geriatrician. I suspect it was neurologists as well, because they were afraid, one, to make the diagnosis, and they were afraid to say, we don't know how to use this drug. The drug itself is not so hard to use. You know, it's not any harder than difficult than an antihypertensive. But I used to get lots of referrals, and I was set on a committee with the OMA, in which was a sort of mixes primary care specialists. And the representative for primary care said, we need help. We need access one way or the other to advice from people who are knowledgeable of whether the person is suitable and how to use the drug. So do you see something like that happening with this drug?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of education that needs to happen to make physicians comfortable about the diagnosis. And here we are getting at not just a disease stage diagnosis that's less familiar to people, but also a biologic diagnosis. And what do you do with that? And what do you do when somebody looks like they have the phenotype of Alzheimer's and they come back PET amyloid negative? You know, I mean, they're still your patient. They still need care. So there are a lot of challenges that are not comfortable for non-experts in this field. And I do think there will have to be networks with centers of excellence who can then provide support to others, because we're going to need all hands on deck with the size of this population. As you know, not a rare disease. So in order for people not to lose treatment opportunities, we're going to need a lot of providers to participate. But there's going to have to be some kind of tiered system. And in terms of the safety monitoring requirements, neurologists are the most familiar with looking for something called ARIA, but even general neurologists who haven't been involved in anti-amyloid drug development trials, this is something new for them too. So they're going to have to learn, you know, when to order an MRI and how to respond if there's a sign of swelling in the brain or some microbleeds. You know, what do you do? Do you hold the dose, or you know, what do you do? So yeah, it's not like just prescribing a pill and not having to monitor anything. There'll be a lot of education required. But getting back to your point, Michael, about, you know, the cost. Alzheimer's is an expensive disease, And if you can keep people at the mild stage longer, so someone with MCI may still be working, as you know, banking, driving, shopping. If you can keep them, you know, at that stage longer, you are actually saving money. You're doing something good for them and society. Don't want to minimize that, but from an economic standpoint, keeping them in the workforce, keeping their family from having to take on the role of caregiver, this is huge. So we can't afford not to treat this disease early and to slow it down.
Yeah, I know. I read, I can't remember which journal when, but somebody did, you know, a true economic analysis of the cost of dementia, and having witnessed it in family members of mine, it's very expensive. I mean, whether it's a publicly funded nursing home or retirement, whatever it is, it's a lot of money. It can be at $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 a year for somebody who otherwise would be home or some other cheaper thing. So we have to be very careful when we look at cost. And this happened a lot, I remember, at the DQTC. They will look at the cost of the drug. But we had somebody who was a real hot shot, economic, whatever you call them, you know, who would really analyze it differently. And it would often come out that it wasn't expensive. It was really a bargain. So I have a question, because I came across something. I try to keep up, you know, with the journals and stuff. But I saw something about an eye examination, and this has come up and off variously. But this one looked a little bit more significant in that there might be a simple, relatively simple eye examination that could identify people in the earlier stages of Alzheimer's, in particular Alzheimer's. Because one of the problems, as you mentioned, was the biomarkers. You don't want people giving a drug that does have some significant side effects that may be useful, but you're not sure if they qualify in the terms of what their pathophysiology is. So what do you know about that one? I just looked it up. It's just recent.
Yeah. So I know quite a bit about the eye scan. I'm actually the principal investigator on a validation study with a company called RetiSpec. And what they have is a fascinating technology. They have a hyperspectral camera that mounts on top of the usual optometry or ophthalmology equipment to look in the eye. And they get hyperspectral, spatial, and spectral images. And then through a computer algorithm, an AI, they generate a score of whether an individual has the signature of amyloid in the retina. And so the back of the eye, the retina, is actually an outgrowth from the front of the brain and shares a lot of common neural elements. And it turns out, at least in our pilot study, that we can predict amyloid positivity with PET or CSF as the gold standard using an eye scan, 86% sensitivity, you know, area under curve, 88%. So really high. The validation study is ongoing. And I should mention, those were in people with mild cognitive impairment and also preclinical Alzheimer's disease. So very early. The idea that you can have a non-invasive point of care picture of the eye to determine whether you have the biology of Alzheimer's is so appealing. It brings down cost. It addresses access. Optometrists, ophthalmologists, bringing them into the workforce to help detect Alzheimer's. That's a new role for them. They seem excited about it from the ones we've spoken to. And, you know, most individuals over age 65 go for an annual eye exam. So this could be added into a screening process, especially if we have something, you know, demonstrated to be useful for prevention. Secondary prevention. I mean, that'd be amazing that the optometrists or ophthalmologists are doing the screening.
No, that's great. I mean, I just recently had to do an eye examination. I have diabetes, and you know, I went for, and it was a new optometrist for me, and he had a really fancy setup with so he could take a photograph of my retina, and he showed it to me. I was quite impressed, and I could see from what you've described, this could be an add-on. And it does, it's like the same way that a pharmacist, you don't have to go to a doctor because you obviously have allergic rhinitis. You don't, you know, I mean, it's silly. So I think that it looks very, very helpful and positive, and I'm really excited in my 82 years of watching medicine evolve. I mean, 66, so it's a long time, and the evolution of the care of dementia, of the Alzheimer's, going from she's a wee bit dotty to being able to analyze the amyloid plaque, burden of a person is really exciting. So I'm going to have to thank you now. I'm going to call you Dr. Cohen Sharon for sharing your expertise and insights into lecanemab, all the new drugs, and an AB. And that's amazing. If you look at the number of drugs that have come out, all the immunological drugs ending in AB have changed the world of medicine and its potential impact on Alzheimer's treatment. This is a truly exciting time for medical research and patient care. So, listeners, there you have it, a breakthrough in Alzheimer's treatment with the recent approval of lecanemab. We hope you found this episode informative and inspiring. Join us again on the next episode of Medical Narratives for more medical stories and advancements. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the applause button and consider subscribing and leaving us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Until next time, take care and thank you.
Love me.